Okay, thank you, Guifre. Okay, so I'm giving this talk to the program, to the comp, whatever it's called, program. And I realize that probably most of the people in that program are not really all that familiar with the ideas of quantum field theory and conformal field theory in particular. So as most of them appear to be coming from methods that one can apply directly to models on the lattice. So I'm going to start off with a very general introduction that you can probably find in most books written after about 1970 something about what is the connection between the scaling limit of lattice models and quantum field theory, and then I'm going to do a lightning introduction to conformal field theory in 1+1 dimensions. I'm then going to talk about, in general, how you can think about computing block entanglement entropies using path integrals. That applies on the lattice as well as in the continuum. And then I'm going to very briefly sketch a derivation of this very well-known result that if you're in 1+1 dimensions, the block entanglement entropy of a interval of length L goes like log L with a universal coefficient C, a universal coefficient C over 3, where A is the conformal anomaly number of the appropriate conformal field theory. Well, that's probably well known to most people, and probably up to that point, most of the experts in the audience will be completely bored. But I'll then talk about how you can measure other universal information of a quantum field theory, a conformal field theory in general, by considering more general entanglement entropies. Then I'll sort of actually switch back to away from the continuum, back to integrable lattice models, and I'll talk about Baxter's corner transfer matrix method and how that enables us to compute entanglement entropies for integrable quantum lattice models. And then at the end, if I get there, which I probably won't, I'll talk about how we might possibly measure block entanglement entropy in a real experiment. But I won't get there. Okay. So let me start off from a general point of view. So we're going to be talking about lattice quantum models, or quantum lattice, no, not quantum lattices, but lattice quantum models for example, a quantum spin chain or something, or not necessarily though in one dimension, at least to start with, so in D dimensions, in D space dimensions, and we can often think of these as being equivalent to a highly anisotropic limit of a classical lattice model in D plus one dimensions. That is, if you think about the transfer matrix of the classical lattice model, it is equivalent in this extremely anisotropic limit where the time steps are extremely small to a Hamiltonian of a quantum model. that is a standard way of thinking about it. Though I should stress this plus one dimension is imaginary time, and of course getting results in imaginary time and then continuing them to actual real-time measurements is quite interesting, or maybe. But as you know, it's a very useful thing to think about quantum models in d dimensions in terms of statistical mechanics models in d plus one dimensions. And this basically another way of thinking about the connection is through the Euclidean path integral. Sorry, that way really, Euclidean path integral. So if you consider the path integral for a quantum model in d dimensions in imaginary time, that looks like the partition function for a classical lattice system. And so it's useful to go back and forth all the time. Now I'm going to think about a lattice with a spacing, which I'll call A. And what do I mean by the scaling limit? I consider taking the continuum limit or the lattice spacing to zero, keeping the correlation length in terms of the classical system, or the gap in terms of the quantum system fixed. Okay, so the general claim is that in general when we do this we get a quantum field theory. Now when I say we get a quantum field theory, of course there's a lot more to a quantum field theory just than that, but I will explain it a bit more. If we're close to a quantum critical point, you see, this basically means that the correlation length has to be much bigger than the lattice spacing. Therefore, we must be close to a critical point. And in case of the classical model, this will be a classical critical point, a second order phase transition where the correlation length diverges. In the case of the quantum model, this will be a quantum critical point. Now, as you know, in quantum models, the nature of the critical point is dictated by what's called a dynamical critical exponent, which tells us basically how the frequency scales with the wave number. Okay, so in general, it scales like the frequency to a power of the wave number. The kind of quantum critical points which we can usefully describe using the methods that I'm talking about here correspond to the case z equals 1, which corresponds to a relativistic dispersion relation. It corresponds to the fact that in the presence, when you have a non-zero gap, the dispersion relation is basically the square root of v squared k squared plus delta squared. And that's true for k much, much less than the inverse of the cutoff, much, much less than. Okay, so we're going to be looking at the kind of lattice models which close to a quantum critical point have a dispersion relation like this. V, of course, doesn't have to be the speed of light. It's the speed of phonons or the Fermi velocity or whatever. And in any case, I'm going to be working in units where V equals 1. So in that case, the correlation length in the spatial direction inverse is just going to be basically equal to the gap. The advantage of relativistic quantum field theories is that we can rotate between space and imaginary time. And in real time, those, of course, just correspond to Lorentz transformations. Now, what do we mean by the fact that the scaling limit of the lattice model is a quantum field theory? Well, to be a little bit more explicit, if we think about the correlation functions, the correlation functions of our lattice model, okay, so these are expectations of products of local observables or even non-local observables in our lattice model, then as we take the limit A goes to zero, in general, these do not converge to something. They either converge to infinity or zero, but if you renormalize them, that is multiplied by a suitable power of A, which depends upon which observable you're talking about, the statement is that the limit A goes to zero exists, and it's equal to a correlation function evaluated in the quantum field theory. Okay, so this is a statement of belief more than anything else. Within perturbative quantum field theory, we can prove it. In other cases, we can just hope it's true. There is one case where we do know it's true, and I'll mention that later. One thing that the existence of this limit implies is that we have scale invariance or scale covariance. Because this limit exists, we could take A goes to zero, or we could take any number times A, any constant times A. And that means that, in fact, if in the quantum field theory we multiply all distances by a constant B in the quantum field theory, that gives us b to the minus 2 x phi times what we would have. Okay. So under scale transformations, the correlation functions are not invariant, but they're covariant with these things which are called the scaling dimensions. And one thing this particularly implies is that if you look at the two-point function in the full plane, in R to the D in general, and still in an arbitrary number of dimensions, this is going to go like 1 over R1 minus R2 to the 2 x phi. So these scaling dimensions tell us how the correlations decay at a critical point. Yes, excuse me. So in the case where we're at a critical point and there is no other scale in the theory, this scale covariance tells us that the two-point functions have to decay as a power, as do the three-point functions, the four-point functions, etc. Now, this scale covariance in many cases gets, in fact, lifted to a larger covariance under what are called conformal transformations. So basically, what I do is replace this by some R1 prime, R2 prime, where now B of R depends upon R. So I'm going to look at scale transformations where where the scaling factor, the rescaling factor, actually depends upon where I am. So in general, the statement is that if I consider a mapping of my space under which r goes to r prime, which is some function of r, then I'm going to have that phi of r1 prime, phi of r2 prime at the critical point is going to be b to the r1 to the minus x phi, b of r2 to the minus x phi, phi of r1, phi of r2. Now, this can only be the case if locally this mapping looks like a scale transformation or a possible rotation. And that defines what we mean locally by a conformal transformation. So locally, a conformal transformation is one that looks like a scale transformation or a rotation. So only for certain mappings is this true. Otherwise, we would have some kind of general coordinate invariance or something, which we don't have, certainly. OK, so this has to be, in fact, conformal. And once again, this is a statement of belief, which we can check in various kinds of perturbation theory, etc. Except one should actually mention that in the scale, that for the Ising model, the two-dimensional Ising model, and two-dimensional percolation, which is not really a quantum field theory, but anyway. This has been proved by Smirnov, and it's basically what he got the Fields Medal for that year. So you can imagine that for this proof to be actually worth the Fields Medal, it must be extremely hard to actually prove these things. And yes, and indeed it is. But we're going to assume it's true. Okay. Okay. Now, actually, all I've said up to now has been true in an arbitrary number of dimensions. But now, I'm going to start talking about d equals 1 plus 1. And now, if we're in Euclidean two-dimensional space, so we're now in R2, then we can talk about complex coordinates. That is, we can think of R2 as being the complex plane, and then what these conformal mappings, z goes to z prime, is a function of z, are going to correspond locally to analytic functions, because everybody knows that analytic functions are locally conformal. And what this equation then says is that phi of z1 prime, z2 prime, is basically the Jacobian to the minus x phi, the Jacobian to the minus x phi, times phi of z1, phi of z2, except that when we think about this globally, what we're really doing is that we're taking a domain D in the complex plane, and we're conformally mapping it to another domain, D prime. And so this is evaluated in the domain D prime, and this is evaluated in the domain D. Okay, that's important. Now,
John, I'm a little confused. The powers on the f prime.
X phi, yes. Yes. Excuse me. Okay, now one particularly important conformal mapping is the logarithmic mapping. So we're taking z in the complex plane, actually minus the origin, and we're taking f of z to be L over 2 pi log z. And what this does is to map the complex plane into a cylinder, basically. So this quantity lives basically on a cylinder of circumference L. So it's actually an infinite cylinder of circumference L. So the origin here in the plane gets mapped to minus infinity. And the point at infinity in the complex plane gets mapped into plus infinity, and going around the origin in the complex plane corresponds to going around the circumference of the cylinder. So these two geometries are conformally equivalent, and this equation here tells us that if we know the two-point functions, for example, in the plane, which we do, we can actually compute the correlation functions on the cylinder. And that's an extremely easy thing to do, just using this formula here with the function here. So I won't go through that. If I choose coordinates going along the cylinder, where that's tau, so I'm going to think about this as imaginary time now going along the cylinder, and now space I can call, say, it doesn't really matter because I'm not going to really use it, but basically I'm going to think of that as space. So now I'm going to think of the cylinder as going back to being a quantum field theory on a circle, with this being imaginary time. Okay? And when I compute the correlation function phi of tau, phi of zero on the cylinder, and I'm not going to worry about the space coordinates, what I find is that this goes like 2 pi over L to the 2xy times e to the minus 2 pi xy times tau over L. So it decays exponentially on the cylinder with a correlation length which goes like proportional to the circumference, as it should be according to what we call finite size scaling, but a particular correlation length. Now, if you think about this from the point of view of this quantum field theory on the circle, with this being imaginary time, if you think about the Hamiltonian for that quantum field theory, then the generator as being the generator of infinitesimal translations in tau, so the way I propagate a state here along the cylinder is e to the minus h cylinder times tau. So that's an operator acting on a space of states on my circle here, okay? You can go back to the lattice language at this point if you want to. Then this is telling you something about what are the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian on the cylinder, and they're telling you that the eigen energies minus the ground state energy are of the form 2 pi x phi over L. Okay, so the eigen values of the Hamiltonian going along the cylinder are related to the scaling dimensions of the all the possible scaling dimensions in the plane. Now, one thing this doesn't tell us about is how the ground state energy itself behaves. So this has a kind of non-universal extensive part. And then there's another piece which also has to go like 1 over L, and this is pi c over 6L. And for the purposes of the talk, I will define this. I will use this as a definition of the conformal anomaly or subtractive charge C. So this is C for the purposes of this talk. Of course, in a conformal field theory, it appears all over the place in other contexts, but I'm not going to explain why here.
Just a quick question. Drive that expression into a formula. The previous formula related the correlators in the cylinder to the plane.
Yeah. So I know them in the plane from here.
Yeah.
Obvious is no constant term. L in independent of L, or it just works.
No, I think it's obvious. If you have periodic boundary conditions, there is no constant term. Okay. Right. So. Okay, now I want to go on to part three, talking about path integrals in general. So let's keep that aside for the time being and just think about how in a quantum field theory we might evaluate entanglement entropies. Well, first of all, how did Feynman tell us to compute the density matrix? Okay. Well, basically, I'm assuming I'm talking about the density matrix of the ground state. So rho is 0, 0. So how do I calculate the wave function of the ground state? Well, what I do is I do a path integral. So I've got space here, and it could be d-dimensional space and imaginary time. And I imagine that I compute the path integral coming in from minus infinity here up to t equals zero. So basically, what I'm doing is I'm doing the path integral over all fields. So this is some set of fundamental fields of my theory. Now I'm thinking sort of in terms of the Lagrangian or something. E to the minus the action, the integral of the Lagrangian, which depends upon phi dt from minus infinity up to zero, conditioned on the fact that phi of x of zero is a particular function, phi of x. So that thing suitably normalized gives us the wave functional of our quantum field theory in the ground state. And the reason that that's true, basically, is that when you go from the path integral to the canonical point of view, what you're doing basically is that you're starting here at minus infinity in an arbitrary state. It doesn't really matter what it is. You're acting in Euclidean time with the Hamiltonian of your quantum field theory. You're letting tau go to infinity. And then that is going to be proportional to your ground state, because it's always going to, as tau goes to infinity, it's always going to pick out the lowest energy state, which I assume is non-degenerate. Okay, so that's how you get the wave functional of your ground state from the path integral point of view. So in order to get the density matrix, what you basically do is you come in here and you come in here this way. So you specify the values of all your fields along here and all your fields along here. And these will give you the matrix elements of your density matrix in the ground state, whose rows are labeled by phi of x, and whose columns are labeled by phi of x prime. Now, you can do this on the lattice if you want as well. It doesn't need the continuum limit. These would just be the density matrix in the basis where, for example, sigma z is diagonal would depend upon a bunch of values of sigma z along here, and also sigma c prime. Right, so basically rho is given by this path integral, which I won't write down again, but of course it has to be normalized by the partition function, which says that the trace of the density matrix is 1, and what taking the trace means is that we set phi of x equal to phi of x prime and integrate over all phi of x, and that gives us the normalizing partition function here. Okay, so that's the density matrix in the ground state. Now, what we want to do to, say, measure block entanglement is that we want to, let's just do it in one dimension. We want to consider the case where space, so this is X now, is bipartitioned into an interval A of length L, say, and the rest, which I will call A bar. So what this means here, for example, is A, okay, in this picture. And now what I want to do, as I'm sure everybody knows, is in this program, is to compute the reduced density matrix corresponding to A, which is the trace over A bar of rho, that is the degrees of freedom in A bar in the Hilbert space corresponding to A bar, okay? And what that means in this picture is, instead of sewing these two edges together all the way along, as I needed to do to compute z, I just sew them along the part which is not A. So basically, this is also given by a path integral over a slit region. Okay, so now I basically have a slit here along A. I've joined together the top and the bottom along A bar, and the values of the fields above and below the slit label once again the rows and the columns of my density matrix, of my reduced density matrix, right? Now, one way that you can get entanglement entropies is to talk about the Renyi entropies, which is that you take the nth power of rho A and you take the trace over the Hilbert space A. And then if you can convince yourself you can continue this to non-integer n, which you can in many cases, then you take the derivative of this with respect to n at n equals 1. You get trace rho A log rho A, and that gives you the von Neumann entropy. But in fact, the Renyi entropies are just as useful for considering the entanglement entropy or the entanglement data, because they in fact encode the what's called the entire entanglement spectrum of the theory. Okay, so well, I'll tell you when I get there that when I start talking about beyond C, it is that when you look at the Renyi entropies, then they start to look different because they just don't depend upon C. But I'll explain that. That is, the corrections to the Renyi entropies are different, yeah, for different n. Okay. Right, so what you need to do, therefore, and this is where I think probably having a blackboard is quite useful, is that we need to consider n copies of this path integral considered in this slit domain. So I'm going to sort of draw them like this, all kind of stacked up, all right, like that. And they're each going to be slit, okay? Slit, slit, slit. And then I have to, in order to take row A to the N, and I'm considering these as matrices, what I have to do looking along here, so now I'm going to be looking along here, I've got my N copies here, in this case I've got three of them, and I have to multiply them as matrices, which means that I have to sew once again, but now I have to sew this one onto this one onto this one, and then I have to take the trace, so I have to sew this one onto this one. So the conclusion is that the trace of row A to the N is given by the path integral on a particular surface, Rn, an n-sheeted surface, which has got branch cuts or branch points at the end of the interval. It's what we call a conifold, because when we do this, when we sew these together, we get basically this n-sheeted surface with a branch cut here, and when we go around the branch points, we go from one sheet to the next. So in order to get back to the same point, going around a conical singularity, I have to go around n times. So there is a delta function in the curvature at this point. Okay. Right, so that's path integrals and entanglement entropy. So now I'm sort of going to put these ideas together of talking about the cylinder, going back and forth between the cylinder and the plane in order to obtain this rather famous result here. So I'm now going to consider this same picture, but not in the plane, but on a cylinder. So I'm now going to suppose that I have n copies of my cylinder, which is going to be slit once again. And now I have n copies of it, and I do the same trick, and then I have then got a branch cut there. Okay? And actually, being on the cylinder, if you think about this as being space, this as being imaginary time, so I've swapped things around a bit here, which I can always do in a relativistic theory. This is why it's really important that I'm talking about a relativistic theory here, that I can keep swapping back between space and imaginary time. This would not work for critical points which don't have a dynamical exponent 1. If I do this, then I've got periodic boundary conditions in imaginary time, which then means that I'm thinking about finite temperature. Now, it's true that the entanglement entropy at finite temperature isn't really a good measure of entanglement in a mixed state, but nevertheless, I can still talk about it. Okay, so let's imagine that our cylinder is really, really long, and I've got a branch point here. Yeah, a branch point here. It has circumference L, except I've really got L of them here. Okay, so I've got N separate cylinders, each of circumference L here. On the other hand, in the middle here, because I have to keep going down through my branch cut when I go around, I have a single cylinder of length NL. So here I've got N times N cylinders of circumference L. Here I've got one cylinder of circumference N times L. Okay? And now I'm going to consider computing the partition function for this thing using this formula here. So I'm going to assume that this distance is tau, very much bigger than L, but the whole thing is going to be a total length capital T, much, much longer than tau. So the way I can compute this partition function is that I can use this formula here, so it's e to the minus e0 times its length. So it's e to the pi c over 6 n times l times tau from this bit here, because it has circumference n times l, right? On the other hand, from the rest, I have e to the pi c over 6 l, but it goes on for length capital T minus tau raised to the power n, because I have n independent ones outside this region here. And then I have to normalize that, in fact, by what I would get if the cut weren't there at all. I get e to the pi c capital T over 6L raised to the power n. So when I work that out, I hopefully get e to the minus 2 pi over L times tau times C over 12 n minus 1 over n. Okay, so that's the partition function. Now I'm going to think about this partition function in a slightly different way. I'm going to think about this as a correlation function. I'm going to think about it as a correlation function of what I'm going to call twist operators. Okay, so I think of this as insertions of rather special non-local operators in the conformal, in n copies of my conformal field theory. And what these twist operators do, so I've got my Hilbert space of my conformal field theory raised to the power n, which has a bunch of fields in it, and these twist operators have the property that when I go around here, then I cyclically permute the fields of the theory. So instead of thinking about this as a conical singularity in space with a single conformal field theory, I think about it as a twist operator acting on the fields of n copies of my conformal field theory. They're completely equivalent descriptions. But this result is telling me what the scaling dimension of this twist operator is. And it's telling me that now if I look at this in R2, in the plane, going back from that cylinder, is that this will decay like 1 over tau to twice the scaling dimension, which is c over 6 n minus 1 over n. So going back to this picture here, where I am in the plane, or n copies of the plane, not the cylinder, what I see is that, in fact, this thing goes like tau to the minus so L, which is the length of my interval, L now, L to the minus C over 6 N minus 1 over N. And now if I differentiate that with respect to N at N equals 1 to get the von Neumann entropy, this is where this equation comes from. Okay, so that's just one way of deriving this. There are many ways, of course. It's not the way that you'll find in the literature. Well, this is the way that Wilczek thought about it originally, by the way. Yeah, sorry?
Is the small l the length of the cut?
Yes. So what I'm doing is here the length of my cut was tau, and it's the same as L, but I'm going back to the plane. Okay. Yeah.
So there's always a V when you go. There's always a speed of.
So I'm always working in units where B equals 1, okay, and you can easily insert those units, okay? And of course, if you were to do this on a real lattice model, there would be a certain V, you know. I mean, depending on the normalization of your Hamiltonian, basically. Yeah. Yeah. Right, so let's see. So at least I should get to 5, which is talking. So what you see from this is that at least in strictly speaking, in the continuum limit, the Renyi entropies contain no more information, or at least the Renyi entropies for a single interval contain no more information than the von Neumann entropy does. Okay, and were I to take this as the literal result and try to actually decode this and ask what is the spectrum of eigenvalues of rho of A, I would get something very universal, but which just depended on C and nothing else. In fact, it tells me about the density, the average density of eigenvalues of the reduced of the reduced density matrix. To go further, what we have to realize is that there are going to be corrections due to the fact that I'm on a lattice. Okay, so what is the form of those corrections? Let me think what I can erase here. So, when I have my branch cut, so I told you I can do all this stuff, of course, on a spatial lattice. You know, it still works. A spatial lattice. And now let's look what is happening actually close to one of these branch points, but now on a lattice. So now I have a lattice. Okay, and I have a lattice here in theory in imaginary time as well, except I'm taking some extreme anisotropic limit where the interactions in one direction get extremely large, but let's not bother about that. Now, for most of the bulk here, I'm talking about being at the critical point, so the couplings in the x and y direction are tuned to be at the critical point. But let me consider a particular site here, okay? Then it's actually different from a typical site. A typical site on the square lattice has four nearest neighbors, right? And so the strength of the, and I'm tuning the strength of the interactions to be at the critical point. But what happens here is that I think about how many nearest neighbors does this point have, then it has of order n nearest neighbors, or of order 4 times n nearest neighbors, or instead of just 4. So this means that, in fact, when I do this, this point is actually more strongly coupled to its neighbors than a typical spin in the bulk. So locally, it looks like this region is not at the critical point, even though I've tuned all the bulk couplings to the critical point. Now, from the quantum field theory point of view, that means that extra operators can actually sit here, and they will sit here, because they're going to be, when I increase the couplings, the energy density is going to be larger, so there are going to be extra operators, for example, the energy density. So when I go to the continuum limit, I've got to think on my cylinder here that there may be, in fact, additional operators sitting here. And using this formula here, what is going to happen is that there's going to be an additional term here, e to the minus 2 pi x phi, whatever is the scaling dimension of that, divided by nl, because there are n, because this part has a circumference n times l. So from the point of view of going up, going along here, it looks like these operators inserted close to the conical singularity actually have a scaling dimension x over n. Okay, so that means that in fact the corrections to this are of order l to the minus 2x phi over n, where in principle all possible scaling operators come in here. So now l is now measured. Now, in order to get this dimensionally right, L is really measured in units of A, the lattice spacing. So you see, as the lattice spacing goes, excuse me, this is 1 plus this. Okay, so these terms go to 0 relatively as the lattice spacing goes to 0 at fixed L, but they're actually there when you do a calculation. These are called corrections to scaling, but they're very, very strange corrections to corrections to scaling. Usually when we look at a model at or close to a critical point, we get corrections to scaling coming from what are called irrelevant operators. That is, they're things that flow to zero under the renormalization group. So we still flow into the same renormalization group fixed point. Typically, those go like negative powers of L, but they're the same, whatever you choose to measure. Here, what we're saying is that if you actually measure different Renyi entropies, that is, Renyi entropies for different values of n, you actually get different corrections to scaling. And actually, then when you start taking these into account, this is telling you something about the spectrum of eigenvalues of rho A. It's all these corrections that in fact start to encode the fine structure of the entanglement spectrum. Okay. So that's one way that we can go beyond C. Another way that we can go beyond C, and yeah, sure.
And we are trying to find what are the coefficients?
Well, the coefficients are in general non-universal. Okay. So they depend on the details of the lattice model. I won't get to part six, but let me just say, in the case of integrable lattice models, you can compute all of these powers, and you find them there, with certain coefficients, right? And that means, and these so if you have an integrable lattice model, the entanglement spectrum is highly degenerate, which is somehow something to do with the fact that it's integrable. When you and then these coefficients all have certain very special coefficients. In a general model in the same universality class, they have different values, and then all this degeneracy in the entanglement spectrum will be split in a non-universal way.
Should one form, we're talking about a classical lattice model?
No, a quantum. Yes, no, a 1 plus 1 dimensional quantum model. And we're talking about the entanglement between one part of the system and another part.
Okay.
should the formula, should the correction term contain a summation over fields here?
Yeah, yeah, sure. So I've just talked about one. So this is a sum over all possible fields with a coefficient which is in general non-universal.
Are they not independent?
Sorry?
That coefficient independent?
Yes. And in some cases we can actually calculate it. Well, I haven't got that. Yeah, well, I'm probably... No. You can use the CTM for quantum models as well. No. Absolutely. You can use it to solve the IC model in a transverse field if you want, or any model which is integrable by Young-Baxter methods. Okay. Anyway, I won't get to that because I want to say one more thing about how we have more information if we consider more complicated geometries. And so far I have talked about the case of just one interval in an infinite system. And there's been a lot of discussion in recent years about what happens when I have two intervals. So I'll briefly talk about this. Two or more intervals, in fact. So in this case, let's assume we have an infinite system, and I have two intervals, call them A or A1 and A2, just so we don't get confused, and all the rest are. And we're looking at the entanglement between A1 union A2 and the rest of the system. If you actually calculate the entanglement entropy of this minus what you would get by considering A1 and A2 individually, what happens is that these leading terms that I've talked about here cancel, and you get zero, and then you get the mutual entanglement, and this contains a lot more information. So how can we calculate it using these kind of methods? How can we get predictions for this from quantum field theory? Well, what I said about the path integral goes through exactly as before. We consider the path integral on some n-sheeted Riemann surface, but now we have branch cut here and a branch cut here. So we have this n-sheeted Riemann surface where you go around here and you go from one sheet to the next. You go around here and you stay on the same sheet, and you go around here and you go around here and you do something complicated. Okay. So we would like to compute the path integral here. And this is quite hard in general. We have done it for a free boson and a free fermion and the Ising model and a few other things. But it involves some pretty interesting mathematics, which was actually all developed in the context of string theory. However, one thing that one would like to say is, let's suppose this interval has length L1, this interval has length L2, and they're, roughly speaking, a distance r apart. What happens if L1 and L2 are much, much less than r? Can we get some kind of an expansion in powers of L1 and L2? Well, in terms of these twist operators, what you're basically doing is considering a four-point function of these things, where, so I've got a tau n here, a tau n here, a tau n here, and a tau n here. And so these two guys are close together, these two guys are close together. And there's a standard method in quantum field theory and conformal field theory, in particular called the operator product expansion, OPE, which says that whenever two operators are close to each other, so here, this is at the point R minus L over 2 and the point R plus L over 2. So I can write R minus L over 2 and R plus L over 2 over a sum over all the operators in the theory, except these are the operators in n copies of my conformal field theory. So it's a little bit more interesting than the usual OPE. Okay, so these copies are labeled from J equals 1 up to N. I can label the operators as being phi kj. So what I'm basically doing here is summing over all these integers kj, which label, so J labels the sheets. Phi kj is an operator on the nth sheet. And then some coefficient C of kj. Okay. So this is the operator product expansion in this context. So what I do is I plug in this operator product expansion here and here. And when I do that, I can basically get rid of my branch cuts altogether, and now I've just got n disconnected sheets, but I've got operators sitting on them. So I've got an operator phi kj of 0 here, phi k prime j prime of r here, okay, and these are sitting on disconnected sheets, so they only talk to each other if they're on the same sheet, and moreover, they only actually talk to each other if they're the same operator. There's this orthogonality that you have in conformal field theory. So the point is that you can write the trace of rho A to the N in this case as a sum of all integrals kj of c kj squared times L1 over L2 over R squared to the sum over j x kj, where x kj is the scaling dimension of this. And now if you do it in order of increasing operators, you have this expansion now. Of course, that's fine, but you need to know what these OPE coefficients are. And the point is that you can actually, in this case, you can compute them all. Because it turns out that if you consider a single interval, thinking now back in terms of the n-sheeted Riemann surface, I want to expand this in powers of operators here. How do I probe what these coefficients are? Well, I put other operators around and compute their correlation functions in the presence of this branch cut, which I can do. And it turns out that these things, then, these coefficients here, depend on the endpoint functions in general of my conformal field theory. So they probe not just all the scaling dimensions, but they probe the OPE coefficients, they probe the endpoint functions, the five-point functions, all the information about the conformal field theory, in the plane anyway, is contained in the entanglement entropy of two intervals. Okay, and so if from a density matrix RG point of view, you can get accurate enough information on the ground state wave function, you can pull out all the information about, all the universal information about the conformal field theory. I think I should stop there. And I will be happy to, so I've got really as far as there, and I'd be happy to answer questions in private about the rest. Thank you. So I started very easily and I got much more complicated. Yeah.
Could you give us an explicit intuition of how the bosonic compactification radius shows up in this multi-part?
Yeah, because the scaling dimensions depend upon it.
Is there a closed expression or something?
In the case of a compactified boson, we have an explicit expression in terms of theta functions on this Riemann surface, right? So I don't know how explicit that really is. But then you can start making this small modulus expansion, and you can start pulling out all these terms, yeah. That's what we've done in a recent paper that we just posted to the archive about a month ago. Yes, David?
Clearly, you need all the information, the coefficients, the operator, the extensions, the dimensions, to get calculate.
To get the full answer, yes.
But you suggested that it works both ways.
Well, what I mean is that, well, so in a general case, what I'm computing is the partition function on this n-sheeted conifold, right? Okay. And in string theory, that's something that people might think about, though only for free bosons or compactified bosons do they have explicit answers, right? Or for a free fermion or something. So that's really what you're doing. But what I'm saying is that for any conformal field theory, this small modulus expansion has a generic form, and we can compute the first few terms just in terms of, first of all, the operator contents of the theory, and then the next term involves the three-point functions, so the OPE coefficients, and then it gets worse and worse.
But the converse isn't true. If you knew the that wouldn't completely determine all of the PE coefficients.
Well, because there'd be degeneracies and things. Yes. Yes.
That's one way.
Yeah, it's probably true. That's like saying whether the partition function on this particular Riemann surface tells you everything about the conformal field theory. Yes, and you know that's not true, but you know that actually you don't need too much more data. And in fact, you do know it. Yeah. Yeah.
When you explain Wilczek's approach to calculating C, I was expecting that you'd have to uniformize the conformal. Is there an approximation involved there by not doing that? In other words, that conformal is conformally to a non-singular manifold. It seems to me that's probably the correct place to do the calculation.
Yes, and that's the way that we did it later. Okay, so with Calabresi and I, about 2000 or something, that's the way we actually did the calculation by smoothly doing it, yeah.
And I presume that transformation incorporates these finite size corrections, which you motivated by a little lattice argument. You know, the fact that there were order n nearest neighbors, that presumably is reflected in the change of coordinates.
No, because you actually do it all in the conformal field theory. So you do something which is okay, which is not rigorous. Okay, because what you do is that you take so you do it in terms of the stress tensor of the conformal field theory away from the conifold points, right? So you compute that, and you use the same formula as you would if it were a smooth conformal transformation, and that's okay because you're actually away from the singularity. Now, if you wanted to make it more rigorous, you would just smooth things out, do the transformation, put them back in. But there will be some point there where you were doing something which was non-conformal, and then it would be tricky. But I'm sure it's okay, you know.
Thanks, Lecture. My CP by some relevant perturbation.
Can I extract,
say, if I'm away from criticality, can I extract, say, from universal quantity given
Yeah, well, well, basically what I didn't say was that, of course, this result here, you know, I mean, so because it's a logarithm, then if you go away from the critical point, then you just replace L by the correlation length. But then all the corrections here are also powers of the correlation length, but their coefficients are not the same as they would be in powers of L at the critical point. There's universe, as usual, there's universality in the powers, but not in the coefficients, right? In the amplitudes. That's not to say there might be some peculiar ratios of amplitudes which could be universal, brother.
Paul has a question here. So in this correction to the Renyi entropy, I would have thought that if you latticize them all the copies the same,
yeah,
then there would be all these symmetries, so you wouldn't get all operators in this expansion.
Well, you don't get all operators. What you have to get is you actually get operators such that, well, it depends upon n. Okay, so it's very strange. Okay, so it's the same thing here. What happens is that if in the fusion of these n operators you get the identity operator, then they contribute.
Okay, that's crucially dependent. So this
on,
would be very
on
different.
N. So I didn't say so. These depend upon n. I think, as I told somebody, yeah, and they depend quite crucially on n.
So there's lots of zeros.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
One last question.
And that reflects somehow on the entanglement spectrum. Missing away, don't you say?
The replica trick likes to be non-rigorous. Okay?
Well,
the problem is not so bad.
Well, for a finite system, it's completely rigorous, right? So if you have a finite number of eigenvalues, in the cases that we have looked at where we've actually done calculations, then we've used Carlson's theorem to actually prove that there's at least one unique analytic continuation, and it seems to give the right answer.
But what I want to do actually is other alternative methods, like random matrix theory, the supersymmetric methods or something like that.
Well, no, it's because you're not going to n equals 0, you're going to n equals 1, of course. So I don't know of any other particular ways. This so-called replica trick is just a natural thing to do. And in any case, so if you know the Renyi entropies for integer n, and you make some very mild assumptions about the uniqueness of the analytic continuation, then you know it for sufficient values of n such that you can construct the, you know, it's a problem of knowing the moments of a distribution and inferring the distribution. But here, things are much, much better controlled because you know the distribution of the eigenvalues isn't too crazy.
All right, let's have a little time, John, again.